Hello?
It's about you.
Okay.
Hi, Brandy.
Hi, about you.
He's not on yet.
Oh, okay. I'm going to turn off my AC.
Good evening.
Good evening.
We'll be starting in about 1 minute.
Okay.
Please join me in saying the Anabakoah. Anabakoah. Gedula Chimita.
Nah.
Ah, that's the
Sunday.
Yud Gimel Lamed Hey Zion Shabbat
Kabel
And the letters of the month of Tammuz, the Ka that created the planet we call the moon, and the Het that created the constellation Sartan, which is the Cancer, the crab. And the eighth verse we say in a whisper. Reading from the Zohar, from section 4 of the Parasha of Tzitzit, the red heifer. Verse 18. Vayehi Noam Adonai Eloheinu aleinu maaseh yadeinu konanei aleinu maaseh yadeinu konanei aleinu. Daber el b'nei Yisrael Vayikru elecha Parah chai parah v'dach yuta Kai atya v'dacha Dami saveh parah dekabila Min shemala uman hu Lishvala Shor Tida'a Ufne Shor Mechastol Aduma Sumaka Devavda Vipiv Kishav Shana Bein Hachofim Aduma Yizrat Dina. Speak to the children of Israel that they bring you a red heifer. This cow is for the purpose of cleansing, to purify the unclean, which is Malchut, that receives from the left. Who is on the left? It is the ox that is Gevurah in Zerantin, as it says, the face of the ox from the left side. Red means red as a rose, as written, like the rose among thorns. Red means a sentence of law, since the laws of the left column are considered red. Red is a color of judgment. This verse is beginning to explain what the red heifer is about. And the idea of the ox, which is the same as a cow, is on the left, has to do with the left column, the desire to receive. The red, it's red because it represents judgment. In fact, it cannot even have two black hairs in its first year of life, in all the millions of hair follicles that grow out of the calf. If two of them are black, it's disqualified to be it being a red heifer, because black represents Malchut, and it has to be connected to Zerantin, which is one of the aspects of the red color. People with red hair tend to have more judgment in that, not so much in their life, as they need to practice greater amount of binding by striking so that they can cleanse the judgment that is around them. Does anybody have any questions?
I'm thinking David had red hair.
That's correct, and so did Ed, so did Esau.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it took a significant amount of binding by striking for David to cleanse that.
Mm-hmm.
transform his hair from red to white. David was a chariot for the Malchut. And when he was born in his early years, that's exactly what he was. He was channeling the left column aspect of Malchut. But as he became king and went through the process of his life, he transformed over to the right column. And Malchut starts on the left, but its perfection is in the center. Are there any other questions?
Do you think some of the Psalms were a form of binding by striking?
Absolutely. There's a lot of secrets, a lot of codes that are concealed in the Psalms.
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions? Go ahead.
What if you weren't born with red hair, but you choose red hair?
I couldn't hear you. Could you say it again?
What if you were not born with red hair, but you choose to have red hair?
In other words, you color your hair.
Yeah, I understand. I hesitate to address the issues of women. There are very few men who color their hair red or they may recolor it black if it's getting gray, or they may color it white because they want to look older. But women are the species that colors extensively and wears makeup. And one of the Midrashim was that the two fallen angels, Azazel and Azazel, were bound in the mountains of shadows for giving women makeup and hair color. So I'm not about to address this issue. If a woman is coloring her hair, it doesn't mean the same thing that it would for a man. A woman choosing red, she's related. She's connected to Malchut, but she's also connected to Bina. And she may very well be intuitive that that is the right thing for her, because Bina is also on the left column. And the left column is red all the way through. But Bina has a lot of mercy as well as judgment. So it's just a Pandora's box that I would rather not get into. It's not that I don't want to answer your question, but your question has to be specific to a person, not as a generalization.
And I suppose the same could be applied to wearing red clothes, some piece of garment.
The only time I would suggest, I would suggest you not wear red clothes on Shabbat. And other than that, whatever clothes you wear is appropriate, because you're really relating the clothes you wear to the mood you're in.
Oh, that's an interesting point.
Or maybe just the energy of the day, and that's your mood is a reflection of the energy of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And that energy of the day is relative to you also, because women are more attuned to the cycles of life. So again, I'm just hesitant to answer the question, because it really needs to be evaluated, case by case. Everything is relative.
Mm-hmm. I've kind of noticed that whatever colors are popular for painting walls in a home, that season, the designers of clothes choose the same colors.
Actually, it's the designers of clothes who choose the colors for the house painting.
It's the opposite, okay.
what there was a period of time when I was in business and I was purchasing the lawn furniture that the lounge that sells for less than $10 retail. There are millions of those sold in this country every summer. And that manufacturer has to know what color is the in color for each summer. And he basically followed by what the dress designers did. And the paint manufacturers do the same thing. But it's all relative to where do those designers get their inspiration? You know, it's really relative to their connection to their intuition. And if you have a designer who's out of sync, his clothes won't sell because he picked the wrong color. And then he won't have financial backers for next year.
Mm-hmm.
You have to look for the cause and effect, but you are right. What you noticed is accurate, that the same colors that women wear in clothes, they also put on their homes. To a degree, it's not as, you know, there's differences, because you can wear a brighter or a cooler color of a particular shade or the shade of a color. Because you can't live with a bright orange, but you can wear a bright orange. That kind of, you know, so, but still the orange would be a color for the summer. So the shade that would be used for the outdoor furniture and the shade for the houses might be a different shade than what the shade for the clothing is. But the essence of the color is always the same. Any other questions? And because of our conversation just now, I have decided that we're starting on Chapter 4, Section 7. Last week we had read Section 6, and I said I wasn't sure what I would do this week, if I would redo it or not. So the handout is available at yashem.com, Kabbalah Advanced Reincarnation 9. There's a hyphen between each of those words. It's also available by going to the Revealed Wisdom section. Scroll down to the bottom of the page, and in the second from the left column, there's an advanced class called the Reincarnation. If you click on that, you'll be able to get to all of the different handouts for the reincarnation. And we're in handout number 9, Kabbalah Advanced Reincarnation 9, but you'll see that it's very clearly identified. So it's Chapter 4, Section 7. Many chances for the righteous. And I see righteous is misspelled. It needs a T. A righteous person may reincarnate many times to cleanse his sins while he is increasing his reward. But a wicked person will be sent straight to Gehinnom to burn out his sins. Reincarnation is a cleansing. It serves the purpose of a cleansing. Gehinnom serves that same purpose. Why is someone reincarnated and someone else sent to Gehinnom? And why are some people sent to Gehinnom and then reincarnated? Is all based on the actions that they've done in this last lifetime. and based on the judgments that come from the spiritual courts. I'm continuing to read. There's another difference between a righteous and an evil person that will be elucidated now. And in doing so, we will be able to understand what the sages wrote regarding Elisha, who was called Acher, which means the other. Elisha ben Abuya was one of the four rabbis who entered the orchard, or the Pardes. Pardes is spelled Pei Resh Dalet Samach. The initial letters of Peshat, Remes, Drash, and Sod, the four levels in which Torah can be learned. They are respectively the simple meaning, the intimated meaning, the expounded meaning, and the secret coded meaning, which is the most mysterious level that can be known by mankind. Rabbi Akiva was one of these four rabbis who entered the realm of Kabbalah on a mission to bring spiritual rectification to the world during the horrible time of the Roman occupation and the Roman oppression. Elisha also entered the Pardes at that time. Although he was a great Torah scholar, he had not been properly prepared for what he was to witness in the upper realms. As a result, he became a heretic until his dying day. For this reason, he was called Acher, meaning the other one. The sages in the Talmud Chagiga made the following statement concerning Elisha. This statement coincides with a broader general rule that will be considered immediately afterwards. He cannot be judged because of his involvement with Torah. If a righteous person learned Torah, especially if he is one of those from the early generations, then he is not sentenced to Gehinnom. Gehinnom is hell. Gehinnom is the Jewish equivalent of hell or purgatory. A person may be sentenced to that place after death in order to purify him from the sins that he committed. During life, although it is usually a temporary punishment that does not last more than one earth year, the subjective experience may well seem interminable. The Arizal will explain in Chapter 9, based upon the Talmud in Chagiga, that the fires of Gehinnom cannot affect someone who has learned Torah. Thus, in spite of the terrible sin of Acher, he could not end up in Gehinnom because of his many years of Torah learning and scholarship. Nevertheless, he, as well as any other tzaddik who may come under the aegis of this rule, needs to be cleansed of his sins. He must be cleansed of his sins to the extent that he will be able to enter paradise. Therefore, there is no other tikkun for him except reincarnation. For each and every sin for which he did not atone through suffering during his lifetime, and for which he cannot receive punishment in Gehinnom, he will have to reincarnate. He will reincarnate as many times as is necessary in order to rectify each and every one of these sins. The original text is obscure here. The translation is according to the generally accepted meaning. Therefore, he will reincarnate through many Gilgulim in order to atone and rectify his sins. This is not the case for an evil person who can go to Gehinnom to be cleansed there of all his sins. He will not need to come back to reincarnate. Upon this teaching, the disciple and author, Rav Chaim Vital, may his memory be for a blessing, asks a question. Now there is room for a question. Would it not be preferable to go to Gehinnom to immediately clear all of one's sins instead of returning through many reincarnations? Humbly, I, Chaim, will answer this question. The Holy One, blessed be He, is omniscient and knows that if an evil person reincarnates, he will only add to his sins, and the abundance of his transgressions will outweigh his merits. Since it is known that he has already completed the few mitzvot that are absolutely vital to the root of his nefesh, it is better for him to be removed from the world. God removes him from the world and lowers him into Gehinnom to cleanse his sins, while the merit of his mitzvot remains intact. God desires kindness. However, with respect to a righteous person whose sins are less than his mitzvot, the suffering during Gilgulim can cleanse them. The rabbi is alluding to an important rule concerning reward and punishment. The Talmud defines a wicked person as one whose sins outweigh the merits of his good deeds. On the other hand, a righteous person is one whose mitzvot outweigh his guilt. Here it seems the rule is being applied to determine whether his Gilgulim should continue or not. If he is deemed righteous because his mitzvot outweigh his sins, then his reincarnations will continue. His many merits will remain intact even while he is increasing them with each Gilgul. His reward will be tremendous, without limit. This is along the lines of what the sages have said. The Holy One, blessed be He, wanted to merit Israel. Therefore, He gave them much Torah and mitzvot. My commentary. The sin of the Acher is usually not mentioned except there was a sin that occurred after he returned from the garden. One of my teachers explained that the sin was to see two thrones in heaven, one for the Shekhinah and one for the Satan. This is what is taught to what he taught to his students. His most famous student, who never gave up trying to bring his teacher back to the concept of one God, was Meir, the husband of Gloria. Gloria was a woman who wore tefillin and was a sage in her own right. She is quoted in a few places in the Talmud. Excuse me. The vision that the Acher saw in the Pardes is the idea of the war between good and evil, as opposed to the unification that is taught in Judaism, but only explained in Kabbalah. The purpose of evil is to test human beings. This is to bring greater pleasure to the human being when he passes a test. Please realize that this teaching takes a significant amount of effort to truly internalize. And do not make the mistake that you understand it from what I have written here. The Zohar also says that a man who studies Torah may not go to Gehinnom, except for a moment, so that he can elevate those who are ready to leave with him. They will go to the Garden of Eden, and he will return to the earth plane to grow some more spiritual. When you reread this section, please take note of the difference in language that is used when talking about a person whose merits outweigh his sins versus a person who needs to be cleansed of his sins. There are many stories of tzaddikim who went to their individual judgment day or viewed the judgment day of someone who had carriages filled with black and white angels, and each one would stand on the scale of justice. The metaphor is not complete, and it is important for you to tear it out by its roots, the Christian influence on your knowledge of the word sin in English, and the five words that are translated as sin in Hebrew. The words are chet, pesha, and avera, plus others that I do not yet understand. By the way, I am still working on myself, tearing out by the roots this influence. That's the end of section 7. I will add one other point that's not on the handout. If you write on a piece of paper the four letters, pardes, hey, which is the Peshat level, which is translated here as the simple level, the simple story level. But Peshat also means unclothed, and it is also implying that the simple story is a garment for raw naked energy. All of the energy of the Torah is enclosed or unenclosed by the simple stories. Remes, which usually gets translated as hints. Drash, which usually gets translated as allegorical meanings. And so, secrets, the Kabbalah. So if you look at those four letters, Hey, Resh, Dalet, that spell the word pardes, which means a garden. But if you permutate the letters as we are taught to do, and you put the samach first, meaning put the Kabbalah, put the secrets first, you transform the word pardes into Sephard. Sephard means stain. But it also means someone who is teaching, someone who is learning the Kabbalah first. Many times people are told you can't study Kabbalah yet because you don't yet know enough of the other levels. And here we learn that a Sephardic person is a person who does know all the different levels, but he puts the priority on studying the Sod. Now, that is not the common uses of the Sephard or the Sephardic term in modern days, but it really should be. Are there any other questions? You're going to find this next section just amazing and overwhelming. Chapter 4, Section 8. The story of Rav Sheshet. The statement of Rav Sheshet mentioned above in Section 4 is clarified by explaining who his previous Gilgul was, and thereby the concept of double Gilgul will be illustrated. Remember, the concept of double Gilgul is the idea of one body with a nefesh that is almost completely rectified, but just a little bit left to do, and a nefesh that has almost nothing rectified, but they're two different souls, two different people, two different nefeshot. And this is called the double Gilgul. Earlier, we spoke of the Gilgul of Rav Sheshet when discussing the concept of double Gilgul. The Talmud says that Rav Sheshet was blind. When he studied Torah, he was joyous, and he would say, rejoice, my nefesh, for you I have read, for you I have learned. The concept of double Gilgul was introduced in section 4 of this chapter. where the statement of Rav Sheshet was mentioned briefly. In order to understand the Ari's explanation of Rav Sheshet, it is necessary to examine the original argument in the Talmud. In the Talmud, Rav Elazar challenges Rav Sheshet's statement according to its first understanding. Do we study Torah just for ourselves, as seems to be implied by Rav Sheshet, or do we study Torah, Rav Elazar asks, because it is a mitzvah and a form of worshiping the divine? As it is written, if I were not for my covenant, the Torah, day and night, then I would not have put the laws of heaven and earth in place. The Talmud answers that at first a person has in mind that he is learning in order to improve himself, and then afterwards he comes to study for cosmic and altruistic reasons, like the contention of Rav Elazar. My commentary. The above commentary will be one of the most important paragraphs for you to manifest as the Torah of your life. We read the paragraph above, please. Not only the answer, but the question as well. The question and the answer is difficult for the Arizal, who will now explore the case of Rav Sheshet, who lived around the time of the writing of the Talmud, in greater detail. This will serve as a further illustration of the double Gilgul. It seems hard to understand when they say he was benefiting himself and not others. It is easier to understand when we contemplate the verse. If you have become wise, you have become wise for yourself. A proverb. In addition, why did he specifically say, my nefesh, and why is all of this recorded regarding Rav Sheshet and no one else? Consequently, the statement of Rav Sheshet, rejoice my nefesh, still needs to be clarified. The rabbi will now present a new insight into Rav Sheshet's statement. To answer these questions, we require an introduction regarding his Gilgul. Baba Ben Buta, the pious, was a student of the elder Shammai. All of his life, he daily brought a doubtful transgression offering. A doubtful transgression offering in Hebrew, an asham safek, is the name of a sacrifice that a person might offer in the Holy Temple in Jerusalem. It is offered when a person is not sure whether he sinned or not, and is explained in the Talmud. Baba Ben Buta, as a consequence of his great piety, assumed that he was always in need of such atonement. He brought the offering continuously, every day, although he probably never sinned in any significant way. The main point here is to show that Baba Ben Buta was an extremely pious person. It was Baba Ben Buta who returned as the reincarnation of Rav Sheshet in order to complete some tikkun that was required of him. Since King Herod had taken out the eyes of Baba Ben Buta, therefore he, Rav Sheshet, was also blind, as is known. Rav Sheshet was a reincarnation of Baba Ben Buta, and since Baba Ben Buta lost the use of his eyes in that incarnation, the same thing happened with less pain in his next incarnation. Something that we learn about people. Everything that happened in your last incarnation happens again in this one. The story of King Herod blinding the eyes of Baba Ben Buta is related in the Talmud. The rabbi is mentioning it here in order to indicate that Rav Sheshet, who was also blind, is the reincarnation of Baba Ben Bhutta. In the form of Gematria called Atbash, the letters of spell Baba change into the letters of spell Shesha. The Gematria called Atbash is a method of permutation of letters. It is derived by writing the first 11 letters of the Hebrew alphabet in a column in a descending order. The next 11 letters are written in a column next to the first column, but in ascending order. See the Gematria section and Noterican section on the Yeshem website, especially going through the Revealed Wisdom section. Now we can arrive at the explanation. A person who does not complete his tikkun in his first Gilgul, even if only by a small amount, must come back to complete it in a second Gilgul. When he completed his nefesh in the first Gilgul, except for a small amount, and he reincarnates a second time, then all the reward for the Torah and mitzvot performed during the second Gilgul are for the sake of the nefesh that came to complete its tikkun. At the time of the resurrection, the nefesh will return to the first body within which the majority of Torah and mitzvot that were required of him were performed. It had only come into the second body in a borrowed way. In other words, the nefesh that was nearly complete in its first Gilgul was borrowing the body of the second Gilgul to complete the finishing touches of its tikkun. Rav Sheshet knew his nefesh had first been in the body of Baba Ben Bhutta, a man of great learning and well known for his piety. He only reincarnated a second time to rectify a small amount that had been left incomplete. This made his body sad, because it meant that all of his efforts were for the sake of the nefesh, which in the end would return to the first body at the time of the resurrection. All the benefit of the Torah that he studied and the mitzvot that he performed went for that nefesh and not his body. It was the nefesh that had to rejoice and not the body. Thus, he, Rav Sheshet, would say, "Rejoice, my nefesh, and not me. For you I read, for you I studied. It was for your benefit and not my own, not for my body." At this point, the rabbi has explained the statement of Rav Sheshet, and he has illustrated the double Gilgul. Let us review. Double Gilgul occurs when the entire nefesh is nearly completed. In the first Gilgul, in order to achieve the finishing touches that it needs, this nefesh reincarnates into a second body. In that body, there is a spark of a nefesh to whom that particular Gilgul rightly belongs. However, the reward and merit of the Torah that is studied and the mitzvot that are done in that Gilgul will go to that nefesh that previously inhabited another body. In the time of the resurrection, that nefesh will arise with the body of the first Gilgul, where the majority of its Torah and mitzvot were done. And it will also take for itself all the merit that was earned in the second Gilgul. The spark of the nefesh that was the true identity of the second Gilgul will be left seemingly with nothing. For this reason, Rav Sheshet was sad. He knew that the merit of his learning was going to the nefesh of someone else, and it will arise in the time of resurrection with Baba Ben Bhutta, not with Shesha. Therefore, it was the nefesh that had to rejoice, and not the body. And he would say, "Rejoice, my nefesh, and not I. For you I read, for you I study. It was for your benefit and not my own." Rav Elazar demurs. He disagrees. Why should Rav Sheshet be sad? Do we not study Torah for altruistic reasons and not merely to benefit ourselves? Accordingly, it is appropriate that the merit should go to someone else, Why is Rav Sheshet sad? The Talmud answers that in the first place, a person also wants to benefit himself as well as others with his hard work and his efforts. My commentary. This does not fully satisfy me. The second body will also resurrect with the nefesh from the others. Second nefesh. Why then is the body of Rabbi Sheshet sad? And as a separate discussion, does a ruach have the capability of becoming a double ruach? How about a neshama? And the answer to that question is neither one can become a double. There cannot be a double ruach. There cannot be a double neshama. There can only be a double nefesh. Does anybody have any questions? Classes this coming week will be on Thursday at 10 p.m. will be a Zohar class. Saturday at 10 p.m. will be a Zohar class as well. Saturday night is your first opportunity to do a spiritual action. Monday at 5 a.m. will be the third of our Sefer Yetzirah class. And at 5:30 p.m. will be the second of our basic classes in Sacramento. And at 8:30 p.m. will be the third class in our Sefer Yetzirah series. No, excuse me, in our phase advanced classes titled the Four Phases. And then next Tuesday we will again have a reincarnation, advanced reincarnation class. Does anybody have any questions before I wish you a good evening? I should have read section 4 over again for you, but I thought I made it clear what the double good rule was all about. I hope you have a beautiful, beautiful week. Shalom, you all.
Okay, shalom.
Shalom.
Good night.
Good night.